Jimbo Haddon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-504-6626. Patriotism is not enough. Harry Jaffa, Walter Burns, and the arguments that redefined American conservatism from Encounter Books, written by Stephen Hayward, our guest tonight, as we look at the various twists and turns. We haven't even talked, of course, about the new, if you will, nationalistic conservatism, if you want to call it that, of Donald Trump, who, of course, has been all over the map on a lot of different issues, not always to, shall we say, the pleasure of people who have been fairly consistent in their conservative views, and we'll get to that before the night is out. But right now, a call from Doc in Wilmington, Delaware. Hello.
Yes, I have an interesting perspective on Dr. Burns. I had a personal encounter with Dr. Burns here in the state of Delaware before he died, and he made a very interesting comment on immigration that I would like your guests to comment upon. To which he stated to me, if allowed to do so, that the Asians would be the future of this country, much as the Jews have become the future of this country in academia, in the arts, and in the professions. The Asians would become the Jews of the future. I'd like your guest to comment upon that comment, and if he's aware of that comment by Dr. Burns.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that one, but I can say that, because it actually is an element of my book, is that, you know, Harry Jaffa was a Jew and, you know, went to actually Yale University in the 30s at a time when Jews were discriminated against actively and overtly by Ivy League universities. You know, they had quotas to limit the number of Jews admitted to universities. Well, guess what's happening now? There's very compelling and overwhelming statistical evidence that Asians are being discriminated against in admissions to our elite universities. And I'm going to run through the numbers on this. It's not part of my book. I think there's going to be some lawsuits getting to the Supreme Court about this, because it's a clear case of racial discrimination taking place right now, because you have a very large cohort of high-achieving Asians, and the universities don't want too many of them in their universities. And that's absolutely clear of Harvard and Yale and Princeton and places like that.
Yeah. So, he's aware of it, Doc. Anything else you wanted to add?
No, I just thank you again for having
sure.
me as a guest, and thank you again for having me as a guest. Mr.
Absolutely. Adam. Thank you, Doc. Appreciate your thoughts and your listenership as well. Regarding Donald Trump, of course, on various issues, it's hard to fully understand exactly where he's coming from any kind of ideological prism. Abortion, he's been for it, against it, and several things in between. In terms of trade policy, now there's certainly an area where he's definitely not your classic conservative Republican. Entitlement reform, he's not in favor of that. He wants to leave all of that alone. Just exactly how that's going to square with the whole system collapsing in a few years, I'm not sure,
right.
Even beyond practicality. But the bottom line is that you can talk about various strains of conservatism, but it is a stretch to call Donald Trump necessarily, quote, conservative. Oh, I suppose the stronger national defense would be considered conservative, and defending our borders would be considered conservative. But, I mean, mostly he's just Trump. And to try, I'll put it this way, he has shown a great versatility of conviction over the years.
That's putting it mildly. Yes, I mean, I've thought all along that he was not a person of any fixed principle. Or certainly he's very flexible, right? I think he has, with the exceptions that are important that you noted, he is, however, governing so far as a conservative.
It's like he's been shopping for a point of view and decided this one looks good. I mean, I'm happy he chose the one I happen to be following. But
yeah, although I think the reason, I have a theory about why he's moved so sharply and decisively that way, and I think it's because I think he was surprised at the ferocious attack from the left when he became a presidential candidate. It's one thing to criticize the things he said about immigration or whatever, but calling him a fascist and all the other things that have been thrown at him. It's a person who, I think he gave more money to Democrats than Republicans over the years, and was a Democrat for a lot of his life. And he's done lots of charity events with civil rights organizations, and they've all turned on him with an extraordinary ferocity. And so I think he's decided to say, well, I'm going to go with the other team then. I think it may be almost that simple. His positions are not conservative orthodoxy on trade and entitlements. And there is a big debate going on right now among thinkers on the right about precisely the distinction between nationalism and patriotism. I think they're not quite the same thing. And, nationalism is kind of in a foul order because it's thought, at least in Europe, to to be the cause of wars, right? It's, you get, you know, national pride is what explains part of what happened in Germany in the 30s and so forth. And, you know, patriotism is a bit of a different thing, I think. And although there's overlap there, I think, you know, people used to say patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels, right? And I forget who that goes back to, but I think they are distinct, and I think that reopening some of these questions, as troublesome as there are, is probably a healthy thing for us all, ultimately.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you that it is a good question that that should, in fact, be reopened. We'll take some more calls, continue our discussion with Stephen Hayward. Again, the book Patriotism is Not Enough, Harry Jaffa, Walter Burns, and the Arguments That Redefined American Conservatism. We'll come back and we'll take a look at some of the thoughts that have gone into this, including some of your thoughts as well, at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. This is clearly part of the great national debate right now, in which many, many people are rallying around the Z word, conservatism. But again, whose conservatism? That's the key issue here. More to come in just a moment. American conservatism. Interesting concept. It comes in a lot of varieties, as we're learning tonight from Stephen Hayward. Again, his book, Patriotism is Not Enough. And let's talk to Chris in Hampstead, New Hampshire. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
I was wondering, are you familiar with the Frankfurt School in New York City?
The Frankfurt School? I'm not.
Wait, did you say Frankfurt School in New York City?
That's what he said.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, there's the Frankfurt School of, you know, the European thinkers like Gramsci and Adorno and Horkheimer, and they were sort of the cultural Marxists out of the 1940s who came to America. Are you referring to those people?
One.
Or what?
That's the one, and actually Sigmund Freud was a part of them, too, as well.
Oh, a whole bunch of people, yeah. I think that's a very, very powerful and very influential movement on the left. I think, actually, you know, their offspring are the core of the modern new left in America.
That's correct. And when they came over to the United States, they settled in New York. And you know what university had sponsored them?
Well, several universities. I mean, some of them ended up out here in California where I am. But was it the New School or NYU? I don't remember now what their New York connection was.
It was Columbia School.
Columbia?
You know, you think about Columbia.
By Columbia University. School, you mean Columbia University?
Columbia University. And correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the Columbia University? The Columbia School of Journalism, isn't that like one of the best in the country?
Hold on. Did you say the Columbia School of Journalism?
Yeah, is there a connection between...
No, between Columbia University and the Columbia School of Journalism? None whatsoever.
Oh, all right. So that's my mistake. But my question that still is my point. That's sort of a point. My point is that if these people came over they had a lot to do with cultural Marxism. How much does that play? Their division. How much does that play into our patriotism?
Oh well. That I'm going to have to write a whole separate book on that someday, maybe. I'll say this because this may be a bit esoteric for a lot of our readers. It's hard to handle on the radio, but by the 1940s, it was apparent to a lot of really smart people on the left that you know, sort of standard orthodox materialist Marxism had failed. And they developed this very elaborate theory, and you know, there's speckles of Freudianism in it and all kinds of other things that say, actually, it's culture that controls human consciousness, not economics and material factors. I mean, that's part of it, but they try to refound sort of Marxist revolutionary sentiment on a cultural basis. And, I mean, you know, there's a lot of ways to play this out. It's kind of hard to wrap your hands around, and it's got a lot of modern followers. I mean, I think to some extent Michel Foucault, who's sort of the dominant leftist thinker of the 70s and 80s, sort of comes out of that genre to some extent. But I think they wrote a lot of very dense jargon, and so it was never as popular and as accessible as, say, Marx's Communist Manifesto. That was easy to put on a poster, right? And so it's never really penetrated popular consciousness much, but it's very big stuff among intellectuals on the left.
Okay. That answer your question, Chris?
Well, also the birthplace of political correctness, I believe.
Yeah, oh yeah, one of those guys. I forget which one hung out here at Berkeley, where I'm currently an inmate, as I put it. that's
yeah,
a long story.
We'll get to that in a second here, but
okay.
Go ahead. We'll just get to it now. Thank you for your call, Chris. How did you wind up at a place like UCal Berkeley?
Yeah, that sounds pretty funny, doesn't it? Though, actually, I'll give them some credit. There are a number of people here at the university, some administrators and some deans and professors, and you know what they say is they're mostly liberals of one kind or another, but they say, look, we actually realize we have a problem with intellectual diversity, the fact that we don't have very much. And sort of a long story how I came here, but about a year ago I got to talking to people here, and they said, you know, we could actually use a serious conservative person to come be a visiting professor and teach classes and be part of the life of the university. And I said, that sounds like a gonzo assignment, and I'm the right guy to do it.
I have to ask the follow-up. How many times have you been hooted out of your own classroom by students who began destroying the furniture at what you had to say?
No, right.
I mean, that's only partially a tongue-in-cheek question.
Yeah, I know. I haven't had any problems like that. You know, John Yoo teaches at Bull Hall Law School and, you know, was in the Bush administration and part of the controversial aspects of the war on terror. He has had classroom disruptors and protesters, and the university, to their credit, has given him security to make sure he can teach his classes. In my case, I had a great favor from the student newspaper, the Daily Cal, which ran two articles, a news story and an editorial on what a horrible human being I am. And that was actually great, because what it meant was, is I had huge registration for my classes. I've got 180 students in one class. And this is the interesting part. A lot of the students who signed up for my class are actually liberal kids who said they wanted something different. You know, even liberal kids get tired of the same stuff from the same people all the time, and we're having a good time together in class. We have terrific arguments, and they're smart kids here.
So the minute you offer a challenging thought, they don't go climbing back into their safe space and sucking their thumbs?
No, they don't. I sort of explained early on who I am and what I'm about, and I treat everybody very fairly, and I don't ever belittle a student or tell them that they're wrong or, you know, their opinions are crazy. Instead, we have a dialogue. We have a conversation, and they like it, and it's going just great.
Well, that's remarkable in and of itself. We'll come back and we'll talk some more about this book, Patriotism is Not Enough. 1-866-50-JIMBO, our number. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hanna Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. And we're taking a look at Patriotism is Not Enough. Your chapter 5, The Vital Center Cannot Hold. I'll just read part of this here. Mid-century liberalism, the intellectual milieu in which Jaffa, Burns, and the rest of these people came of age, was an odd combination of high confidence and inner confusion. The high self-regard of liberals in the immediate post-war years is entirely understandable. It was a function of both the nation's triumph of arms in World War II and the triumph in politics of the New Deal coalition. And you go on to add, the importance of Harry Truman's come-from-behind victory in 1948 cannot be overstated. All right, what went so very, very well for liberalism then, and then what went wrong?
Right. Oh, boy, that's a long story. Yeah, well, I try to tell a story here that I think people haven't really focused on very well until recent years. I'm not the only person to point this out, but essentially the two parts of it, quickly stated, go like this. If you go back to the progressive era and thinkers like Woodrow Wilson, especially, the best known, of course, of the progressives, they all said, you know, the American founding is obsolete, you know, the Declaration of Independence, we don't need to pay much attention to that anymore. You know, individual rights are overstated. You know, Oliver Wendell Holmes actually once said in a letter that he actually wished that we didn't have the Bill of Rights in the Constitution and wasn't even too sure about the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, for that matter. Well, then what happened? Along came, the unimaginable to the progressives, totalitarian nations that then, of course, led us into World War in the 1940s. And I think that really shook a lot of liberals, including famous people like Arthur Schlesinger, who wrote a famous book in around 1950 called The Vital Center. And, you know, to their credit, and I'm kind of a fan of those mid-century liberals, even though I'm of the other party, they said implicitly, you know, we made a mistake rejecting the American founding and saying we could just leave behind all the great legacy of James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. And they tried to get it back, see. They actually represent a recovery of sorts of the American founding. However, my argument and what I lay out in that chapter is that it was very superficial and left them open to attacks a decade later from the new left, for example, and that you really needed conservatives to offer a more profound and serious and detailed defense of the American founding. And that's what people like Harry Jaffe and Walter Burns, and I mentioned Martin Diamond and a whole bunch of other people of a wider circle of people. I picked on Jaffe and Burns because I knew the two of them well.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this, the drama of the book is that they carried on a bitter feud for years that I always regretted because they really were so much alike, but they managed, like intellectuals, to find a way to fight with each other. And so I tell some stories of their fights, and some of which is kind of funny along the way, I think.
As we go to a call here, I want to offer one thought, and that would be about the person that that many people consider the godfather of American conservatism, and I'm not even talking about Barry Goldwater. I'm talking about Robert Taft.
Right.
How would he feel about what is called conservative today?
You know, that's a great question. You know, he was a really smart man. In fact, I'll just tell you briefly that I knew Milton Friedman pretty well. And, you know, Milton Friedman knew a lot of presidents and followed policy.
University of Chicago, for a lot of people, don't know who Milton Friedman is.
Well, but he was the Nobel Prize winner in economics, and he's responsible for monetarism. And, you know, he's generally considered by most people to be the second most or maybe the most influential economist next to John Maynard Keynes in the 20th century.
But, and diametrically opposed to each other.
Yes. Oh, very much so. Exactly the opposite. Right.
Right? Okay. Now that we all know, but tell us more now about that in that context about Robert Taft.
You know, I asked him one time, who was the smartest president or political figure? And, you know, he said Nixon was very smart, although we know about that. But then he said, and this interested me, of all the political figures he ever met in his long life, Robert Taft was to him the single most intelligent by far. He said he was really impressed with how smart that guy was and how quickly he was able to grasp complicated economic ideas and understand their implications.
Well, that is impressive. All right.
Yeah.
Let us talk to Terry in Akron, Ohio. Hello, Terry.
Hello.
Yes,
yes, Teresa.
Oh, Teresa. Well, okay.
Close enough.
Very sorry about that.
Well, I'm glad you're talking about patriotism because there's a divide today with our patriotism because we have a public employees union and we have Social Security, and now that these illegal people come here that the public sector wants to call refugees. You know, they want to give them our Social Security, you know, our disability, everything, you know, that...
Oh, liberalism is extremely generous with other people's money.
Yes. And so, but the problem is, we're going to run out, the private sector is going to run out of money before the public retirement runs out of money. And we don't know how solvent the public employees union is, but it puts a divide because they're going to end up a class of their own.
Well, to the extent that they can stay in power, that, of course, I guess that's worth bringing up in this particular regard, Stephen Hayward. How far into this administration can Donald Trump go without a major confrontation with the federal employees union, or unions, I guess there's more than one, that will make President Reagan and the air traffic controller seem like a minor disagreement?
Oh, yes. I think that's coming, Jimbo. I think I think that's sort of the big shoe to drop. There's been talk by Trump and people around him that at some point here we need to, and this is decades overdue, we need to revisit the fact that you simply can't fire a federal employee. I mean, it's almost impossible, and that needs to be changed for a whole bunch of reasons. And I think they may take a run at that, and it will be one of the biggest fights you've ever seen, and I think it's one that he can win easily, and he's just the kind of guy to win that kind of fight.
And the state employees, too.
Yes. Well, you know, state by state, I mean, Governor Walker in Wisconsin has been very impressive, and, I mean, he has really done what needs to be done there. I just read a news story a couple hours ago that apparently the Iowa state legislature, now under Republican control, has just enacted, I think, yesterday or today, some very serious reforms that are going to clip the power of the public employee unions there. So there's some reason for optimism. I think that you know, the situation described is very serious, and you're quite right. But you know, there's a fight going on, and I think you know, people on our side of this are winning some of these fights.
Yeah, I would think. As a follow-up to that, and thank you for your call, Teresa, as a follow-up to that, It would seem that at some point, perhaps the simplest way to curtail these unions would be simply to initiate an across-the-board hiring freeze and just simply shift people around as attrition sets in and fill actual needed vacancies. And just let the process of retirements and the like take their toll.
Well, that's one way you could do it. You know, my solution is I'm not entirely facetious about this, but I thought that Donald Trump ought to build a big federal building in Nome, Alaska. And anybody who tries to obstruct him, just send him a little note saying, we're transferring you to Nome, Alaska tomorrow. Or it could be, you know, somewhere in North Dakota that's remote and cold in the winter.
Yeah.
That might be one tactic you might want to try.
I've said that in the beginning tongue in cheek, but the more I thought about it, the more I realized, no. That's a serious proposal. And
right.
if you really cannot fire them,
transfer federal employees
you hassle them out of office. I'm with you.
Yeah.
All right. Stay with us, more to come. Stephen Hayward, the book Patriotism Is Not Enough. 1-866-50-JIMBO, back in a moment. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hannon Show, 1-866-50-JIMBO, our number. Stephen Hayward, our guest, the author of Patriotism Is Not Enough. I must ask you about that icon of American conservatism, Ronald Reagan, about whom you've written extensively. How conservative was he, really? I mean, certainly the budgets in California went up during his governorship. He gave, I think, at best lip service to abortion and other social conservative causes. And I'm wondering if in the climate post-Tea Party, if we didn't have the Gipper and the winner of two landslide elections, but simply a governor of California and has-been actor, if he could even have won a Republican nomination in recent years.
Yeah, I know that's a popular theory, Jim, but I don't think you're actually right about how I think he did more than do lip service on abortion, and some of his initiatives didn't carry off very well, like his court appointments, for example. But I could go through some of that. But I think the broader point to make about him is this: I think he was a fully conservative person, but he had the practical streak of a statesman. In other words, he knew that you weren't going to win everything. He was very good at a compromise whereby he got 80% of what he wanted. It used to drive Tip O'Neill crazy, so they hate negotiating with Reagan because he gets 80% of what he wants every time, and that's because he was good at it. But, you know, on the other hand, people do point to things like you pointed to. He was not as successful as he wanted to be in restraining spending, certainly in Washington. We can't really know. I'm a lifelong Californian, and I was pretty young then, but I think if we'd had liberal governors, the spending would have gone much higher. That was when inflation started to take off, so it's hard to judge those things. But let's compare him to Trump for a moment. Reagan was a free trader, but, negotiated with the Japanese to limit their auto imports, to help protect our own auto industry, and that's part because he thought Congress would do something worse if he didn't. He put in a bailout for Harley-Davidson manufacturing. And he also, when he ran for re-election in 1984, he promised that if re-elected, he wouldn't touch Medicare and Social Security. And now they weren't in as dire straits then as they are now, but there were still problems that you could see in the future. And in his first term, he talked about maybe we should reform them, and Democrats attacked him for that. Well, by golly, in the second term, Republicans in Congress wanted to do something about those entitlements at an early time when it would have been good, and Reagan said, nope, I made a promise in my campaign that I wasn't going to touch those, and so I won't sign any bill you send me that does anything to Social Security and Medicare. And guess what? That's Trump's position, right, that we don't want to touch those entitlements, even
though exactly.
They are now in a state of crisis.
No touching entitlements, massive public works programs to fix our infrastructure, and granted, that goes beyond being a fiscal issue and gets down to whether or not you want people to die and collapse bridges. But you add that, and plus tax cuts, I mean, Donald Trump might do for the federal debt twice as much damage as Barack Obama did.
Oh, I think that's right. I don't think he cares about the deficit at all. That's another departure from Republican orthodoxy. I mean, Reagan at least fought the good fight, and that's a tangled story. Looking back now, he restrained spending more than any president before or since, with the partial exception of Bill Clinton when you had a Republican Congress, doing battle with him over the budget. But otherwise, Reagan's record in retrospect, at the time we thought, oh, my God, these $200 billion deficits are terrible. And, you know, it was a bad
200,
deal,
boy, those were the good old days, weren't they?
They were pretty good.
Now, one of the most remarkable things that I hear are these constant shouts on social media and elsewhere about how Donald Trump is a fascist. Do they even teach about fascism anymore? There's nothing that is more fascist in the purely Orwellian point of view than what I call the Michael Bloomberg attitude in this country.
Yeah, well, that's
seriously.
Right. You know,
and you know, and just a line from your book, progressivism surely did not understand itself as tyrannical. That's kind of odd, isn't it? I mean, if you are arbitrarily telling people what to do, that's tyranny, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to give them the benefit of the doubt of their own intentions and the way they perceive themselves. I think I agree with you that in practice, it's very much a doctrine of unlimited government and therefore tyranny. But yeah, I mean, fascism has become a meaningless epithet that you apply to any politician you don't like, and it's really pretty silly.
Yeah, and beyond silly. We've got about a minute to go. What have I not brought up from Patriotism Is Not Enough that you'd like to mention?
Oh, gosh, I don't know where to start or finish. You know, each chapter could have been a separate book. I do have a chapter that talks a lot about something I mentioned briefly earlier, which is the revival of constitutional originalism. And, you know, I think that's and Jaff and Burns played important roles in that. And I think that's, you know, a really live issue today with the Supreme Court and one that's going to be playing out for years to come.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was a dead debate in the 1950s and 60s, and now it's at the center of every law school, even the ones dominated by liberals, which most of them are.
Interesting. All right. Stay on the line. We'll speak off air. Again, Stephen Hayward, our guest, visiting scholar at the Institute of Governmental Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, the author of the 2-volume political biography, The Age of Reagan, The Fall of the Old Liberal Order, and also The Age of Reagan, The Conservative Counter-Revolution. His website is powerlineblog.com. The new book, Patriotism Is Not Enough, from Encounter Books. I'm Jim Bohannon, and this is Westwood One.